and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, the UAA Seawolf debate team goes up against Harvard University debaters to address the motion, "This House would repeal the Second Amendment." Hosted by the Beartooth Theater Pub, this debate between UAA and Harvard University was recorded on April 25th.
Good evening. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm the director of the UAA Seawolf Debate Program, and I'm particularly pleased to welcome you all here tonight. We've gathered here tonight to engage in the most ancient and noble of academic pursuits, the search for truth through reasoned argument. And it's this search for truth that has inspired me to open my comments tonight with some personal revelations. Personal revelation number one. I know that UAA is going to lose tonight's debate. Tradition holds that the guests at an exhibition debate get to choose their side of the motion. In this case, when given the option, Harvard chose to defend the Second Amendment. That means that UAA is going to propose its repeal. Now, not only, you can give them a hand, that's fine. Not only am I fully aware that arguing that we should strip Alaskans of their gun rights is a bit like arguing that we should outlaw barbecue in Texas, but I'm also aware of the fact that we haven't repealed an amendment to our Constitution since 1920, and in that case, we did so to give ourselves more rights and not fewer. We also did so we could drink more. So it will come as no surprise to me tonight when at the end of the debate I call for a division of the House, and UAA, having proposed to repeal the Second Amendment, is soundly defeated. But that leads me to personal revelation number two. I don't care that UAA is going to lose the debate tonight. And don't get me wrong, I'm competitive. You can ask any member of my team, or perhaps more to the point, my wife. I hate to lose. And I hate to lose whether it's to Harvard or to West Undershirt Community College. I've dedicated my career to teaching people how to win debates, and I don't take that lightly. But that leads to revelation number three. The reason that I don't care is because I regularly practice deception. I mean, not generally, but about one aspect of academic debating in particular, I lie regularly. You see, I often promote the activity of academic debating by extolling its virtues as a training ground for students to develop their advocacy skills. And this perspective on debating is appealing because it suggests that we're sending out into the world students equipped to argue passionately and persuasively for social justice. And we do, and I'm proud of that. But the true virtue of academic debating lies not in making people better at arguing their positions, but in instructing them in the practice of reasoned, respectful discourse, regardless of what they're arguing. Now, much has been said bemoaning the state of public discourse in America, and for good reason. Our political debate often seems predicated on belittling and vilifying those with whom we disagree. Academic debating doesn't tolerate that. To retreat to name-calling in academic debating is the lowest form of offense, tantamount to sweeping the leg or kneecapping an opponent. But I have faith. I have faith in the process of debating. I have faith in these debaters. And I have faith in you as an audience, that we can elevate debate to its rightful place in the human experience. And on topics like this, where both sides have a legitimate claim to the positions that they take, we must. The motion for this evening's debate is this House would repeal the Second Amendment. Recent tragedies involving firearms have renewed our interest in the public policy governing their possession and use. While repealing the Second Amendment isn't currently a policy proposal receiving serious attention in our legislative process, it does frame a larger debate about the utility of our rights and our efforts to balance those rights against other competing interests. Proponents of the Second Amendment claim that our right to self-defense is innate, and that the articulation of a right to bear arms in the Constitution expresses the presumption that should be accorded those rights when framing public policy. Critics of the Second Amendment claim that it's inherently unclear and that it unfairly privileges one side of the debate about firearm regulation. Neither side has an exclusive claim to what's right, and both have legitimate arguments for their positions. It is those arguments that we've come here to test tonight. And I could think of no better advocates to test this question. Representing the opposition and speaking in defense of the Second Amendment are Colter King and Josh Zoffer of Harvard University. Both of these guys have outstanding debating resumes. As a team, they won last year's American Parliamentary Debating Association National Championship Tournament. They won the North American University Debating Championship Tournament, and they qualified for elimination rounds at the 2013 World Universities Debating Championships. And just a couple of weeks ago, Josh, this time with a different partner, repeated and won the APDA Championship again. On a special note, I should add that Colter let me know that this will be the last debate of his academic debating career, and I'm confident that Anchorage will offer him an enthusiastic send-off. I'm also pleased to introduce the home team. UAA, represented by Amy Parent and Wiley Kaysen, will propose the motion arguing that we should repeal the Second Amendment. Amy and Wiley are longtime members of the Seawolf Debate Program and have each distinguished themselves in competition. Amy advanced to the elimination rounds of the 2011 World Universities Debating Championships and was twice a semifinalist at the U.S. Universities Debating Championships. Wiley has twice represented UAA at Worlds and had the opportunity to put his skills to practical use when he managed Hollis French's successful campaign for re-election. And both were part of the larger Seawolf squad who in 2012 rankings published by the World Debating website secured the University of Alaska the 9th ranked place debating program in the world. Tonight's debate will be modeled roughly after the type of debate that happens in international intercollegiate competition. We'll begin with a series of speeches by the proposition and the opposition to lay out their best arguments for and against the motion. During those 8-minute speeches, you're going to hear a bell when there's 1 minute in and 1 minute remaining in each of the speeches. It sounds like this. That bell indicates that points of information may be asked by the opposing side in the intervening 6 minutes of the speech. Points of information are brief interruptions from the opposing side and may take the form of a question or a brief statement. Keep in mind that the decision to accept a point of information is at the discretion of the speaker holding the floor. You may see debaters refusing POIs by saying not at this time or by merely waving their opponent down. They're not being rude. They're expected to manage their time appropriately. Following the constructive speeches, we'll open the floor, open the debate to speeches from the floor to hear what you have to say. We'll call for those in the audience who want to speak in favor of or against the motion to come up front and literally have your minute in the spotlight. We'll do that for about 20 minutes or until we've had a chance to hear a variety of opinions, and then we'll return to the debaters for a 5-minute summary speech from each of the sides. We'll conclude the evening with a division of the House, wherein we'll have an opportunity to express our sentiments collectively about whether or not we support the motion to repeal the Second Amendment. A couple of notes will help you enjoy the debate. First, please take this opportunity to silence any cell phones or other communication devices that make noise when someone wants to contact you. Second, you're encouraged to support the arguments and the advocates that you find compelling. The traditional way to do this, if you've ever watched any debates that happen in the British House of Commons, is to pound on the table and say, "Hear, hear." It's a good time to practice that now so you know how that works. Go ahead and say, "Hear, hear." Excellent. That's a great sound. The final note I would offer about the format of the debate is this. Keep in mind that the goal of an academic debate is to thoroughly interrogate the question before the House. The debater's role is to mount the most vigorous defense of the position that's been assigned to them. The arguments made by individual speakers may or may not reflect their personal convictions on the topic. In other words, don't threaten to exercise your Second Amendment rights against any of the debaters. Just because you disagree with them, you may find that they share your disagreement with the motion. There are a number of groups and individuals that deserve recognition for helping us produce this event this evening. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Alaska Airlines, the Rasmussen Foundation, the Anchorage International Rotary, Mr. and Mrs. Rudy von Imhoff, the UAA College of Arts and Sciences, UAA's Concert Board, our Department of Communication and Discourse Studies, and of course, the Beartooth Theater Pub. Thank you all very much for your support. I would also like to take this chance to thank you, all of Anchorage, for supporting debating in the way that you have. It warms my heart to know that not only will our community sell out a debate like this days before the event actually occurs, but that we'll resort to scalping tickets for double face value on Craigslist. You have no idea how long I've waited for somebody to scalp a ticket to a debate. And y'all should anticipate higher prices next year. With that, I'd like to now call the House to order and call upon the first speaker from the proposition to the floor to defend the motion that stands in her name. Hear, hear.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Wiley and I like guns. We have guns, and we most certainly do not want to take your guns away. But what Wiley and I also recognize is the value of discourse. And what we would tell you is that the existence of the Second Amendment hampers fair, open, and honest debate about gun issues in the United States, which is why we are proud to propose that we would repeal the Second Amendment. I have 3 points to bring to you today. First, the purpose of the Second Amendment. Second, the distinct threat that the Second Amendment faces to federalism. And third, the need for open discourse on gun issues and the likely results of that discourse. So first, let's talk about the purpose of the Second Amendment. We recognize the context through which the Second Amendment was created was during a time when our founding fathers were waging a war against a tyrannical government, and the need for militias was apparent. So in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, they added an amendment that said, because we need militias, the people should be able to keep and bear arms, the language of which has been very confusing. And the Supreme Court has also showed that this language is confusing, convoluted, and inconsistent. Throughout many of the Supreme Court cases, we've had differing interpretations of what the Second Amendment actually means. In Presser v. Illinois, they prove that people cannot form their own militias or own weapons for semi-militaristic reasons. In other cases like Miller v. Texas or Robertson v. Baldwin, they showed that regulations like state licensing laws or concealed carry laws do not violate the Second Amendment. And in the case United States v. Miller, it was shown that the state and federal government can regulate the movement of weapons because it is the purview of the government through the Commerce Clause. But then we had a game changer when it came to the District of Columbia versus Heller, in which case it was proven that it was interpreted that individuals had the right to have a weapon regardless of their interaction with any military, and that states could not regulate handguns to the extent that they could before, hence why we saw the handgun ban in D.C. be struck down. What does this tell us, ladies and gentlemen? It tells us that the interpretation and the meaning of the Second Amendment has never been consistent. It has never been true. It has never been static. It has been constantly changing and evolving. And what we think that means in today's debate is that the one single interpretation that we are working with now can change, and it leaves open the possibility that we as a collective can decide what the Second Amendment means, and we can subsequently decide that it is no longer necessary. My second point is the distinct threat that the Second Amendment plays to federalism. As I stated earlier, the Founding Fathers wrote the Second Amendment in order to protect people from tyrannical governments. They didn't want people to be under the rule of an oppressive government, a tyrannical government, or through unfair majoritarian rule. That's even why many Founding Fathers were hesitant to join the war or hesitant to join the Union. And what we would tell you is that today, in this modern context, the Second Amendment is actually becoming oppressive. It is actually taking over and making majoritarian rule in states that would otherwise like to pass common sense gun laws that are more appropriate for their people. We can take a look, example, for D.C. or Chicago. D.C. was once called the murder capital because they had too many guns and not enough enforcement. And so what they decided is that for our people living in this specific group of area, we should be able to make laws to regulate the types of guns that people can have. And the interpretation of the Second Amendment struck down that ban. Our founding fathers wanted federalism. They wanted states' rights and they wanted local rights. They thought that people ruled themselves better in small groups where they were able to actually understand the needs of their community. The Second Amendment, as it exists today and because of its pure existence, stops localities from making common sense laws that make sense for their people, make sense for their demographics, and make sense for their geography. What we would say is that by abolishing the Second Amendment, we actually uphold the real reason we had the Second Amendment in the first place, which was federalism. We think the Founding Fathers would agree with us on this. Before I move on to my third point, I'll take you.
So if you care so much about federalism and allowing states to decide, why should we repeal the Second Amendment so that Congress can decide that no Alaskan should be able to own guns?
What we would say is that that is not a likely scenario. What we think would happen, and I'm going to talk to you about this during my third point, is that the federal government would not be able to create blanket bans, but rather our conceptualization of gun rights would actually move from a right to a utilitarian claim that would still be protected. And I'm going to talk to you about that during my point, I promise. So let's talk about this third point, about why repealing the Second Amendment will allow room for discourse on gun issues. Right now, we have a problem of crowding out. There is currently no space for people who favor reasonable restrictions on guns, and their voices are just not even heard. By people who support the Second Amendment, our lobbyists completely drown out that conversation. It's like having a 100-yard race, and people who support the Second Amendment get a 50-yard start. What we would say is this is unfair, and it certainly does not have a place in our democracy. Let's take, for example, the passage of universal, or this, the lack thereof, the non-passing of universal background checks last week. 90% of Americans agreed with universal background checks. And these are not just people who haven't liked the Second Amendment or just city dwellers living in New York City. No, 90% of all Americans. That includes gun owners. That includes hunters. That includes the families who have been that have been the direct victims of gun-related atrocities, like the parents of those children in Newtown. All of these people came together, 90% of them, and said we should have universal background checks. And what happened? It didn't pass. Even when 90% of everyone in this room agreed that we should have passed that bill, it didn't. Because the people who stood behind the Second Amendment had that on their side, used it as a trump card. It's always a trump card. It is an undeniable, unarguable position that no one can ever come out from underneath of. It is an untouchable refutation. And we think the pure existence of the Second Amendment has created an unfair place in discourse that does not allow for room for other sides of the debate on gun issues. We think that we would probably see some more reasonable restrictions on gun laws if we were going to actually repeal the Second Amendment. We recognize that people around the United States would not put blanket bans on guns because that wouldn't make us happy and it wouldn't make certain other people happy, and guns would not go away entirely. But we do think that repealing the Second Amendment would be more likely to give us universal background checks, competency courses or license, trigger locks, and other important things. What we think we need to do in today's debate is shift gun ownership from the conceptualization of a right into a utilitarian claim. Just like you have a utilitarian claim to driving a car, but you do not have a constitutional right to drive a car. And why is that? Because it would be terrifying if government could not regulate the type of cars that people drive so that you can't drive a semi-truck without the right license, or that if we didn't have age restrictions or blood alcohol content levels. By not having driving as an enshrined constitutional right, it shifts presumption from the drivers to regulators. And we think that in the wrong hands, a car becomes a very dangerous machine. The same goes for a gun. In the wrong hands, it becomes a very, very dangerous machine. And we think that presumption ought to shift from people who own guns to regulators. We think that no one wants to take away people's rights to drive just because we don't have a constitutional amendment that tells you you can drive. We can do the same things with guns. Because we tell you that the purpose of the Second Amendment no longer holds in our society, it poses a distinct threat to federalism, and lastly, we need to open the doors of discourse on gun ownership in America, we're extremely proud to propose.
Yeah.
Before I begin my speech, I just want to say a brief thanks to Steve for bringing us out here, for UAA for hosting us, and finally for the Beartooth Theater Pub for hosting this debate today. So that all being said, in addition to being a Harvard student, I am also a citizen of North Carolina, and I am proud to assert and defend my rights to guns under the Second Amendment. I'm going to do a few things in this speech. I want to advance three constructive arguments about why the Second Amendment is particularly important, why we have a right to self-defense that is only possible to actualize on when you have a right to a gun, and then I want to deal with the arguments that we heard out of Amy. So let's first talk about why the right to a gun and the Second Amendment is important. First, we believe that there is a right to self-defense that can only be adequately realized when you have a right to a gun that is protected by the Second Amendment. We believe that this right to self-defense is rooted in our basic understanding of the self and of autonomy, that without safety, you cannot have any other right, that your rights to property or to speech are not safe unless you can defend yourself. We believe that all rights are premised on a right to self-defense because without the right to self-defense, you cannot prevent your other rights from being taken away. We believe there are a few ways, two in particular, that people in a liberal democracy like the United States could actualize upon this right to self-defense. First, you could have it provided to you by the police. Or, secondly, you could take it upon yourself to defend yourself, and we believe guns are integral to that purpose. We believe, on our side of the house, that the state and the government are not omnipotent, that the state cannot protect you from every threat, and that when the police cannot protect you, you need to be able to protect yourself. So what are the cases in which we believe it is true that the state and the government can't protect you? First of all, we think there are times when the state simply does not have enough resources to protect you and as a result is not able to give you your right to self-defense. Second of all, we think there are people who live in isolated rural areas where there is very little police protection and that they also have a right to defend themselves when the police are not going to do it for them. Finally, we believe there are cases where the police and the government are just not fast enough. When someone invades your home and you need to defend yourself and the police are not there, they have not given you your right to self-defense, and so you have a right to actualize upon it yourself. We want to pose this question to you in the audience. Is there a moral difference between the police shooting a would-be murderer and an individual shooting a would-be murderer who has entered their home and attacked them? We believe there is not one. And the reason we believe this is true is because the police who defend you and the individual who defend themselves are doing the exact same thing. That is why we believe that you need a gun. Because in today's society, where criminals have guns, where your rights are under threat, we believe that you cannot adequately defend yourself without a gun. They tell you a lot of our things about how the Second Amendment was created to protect us from tyranny, that we don't need it anymore because the British aren't going to invade. We believe that this is actually taken out of historical context, that at that point, yes, that was the threat, but that was what we needed to defend ourselves from, that our right to self-defense in the 1700s meant self-defense against the British. We think today, though, that the right to self-defense is just as important, that threats haven't gone away. There are still people who would attack us and take away our rights, and for those cases, we believe we need a right, you need a gun to actualize upon your right to self-defense. Second of all, we believe there is cultural and historical value in the Second Amendment that is thrown away when you repeal it. We believe that our founding was the result of a willingness to buck authority and to fight for ourselves, that this country would not have been founded without privately held guns controlled beyond the boundaries of the state and the oppressive tyrannical government that existed before our own. We believe that the Second Amendment pays homage to this history. It reminds us of our origins and our political responsibilities. We believe that cultural traditions like hunting celebrate this sort of rugged individualism and independence, that our institutions and our culture are built around this mentality, and that to remove the Second Amendment would be an affront to this history and to our identity as Americans. Yes.
Our cultural context also came from slavery. And when society says that this thing is no longer okay, maybe it used to be, but it's not anymore, it is certainly okay for society to say, we don't agree with this anymore, we dismiss it, and we don't find it relevant.
True, but you don't have a right to own slaves. In contrast, you do have a right to self-defense. As long as we can prove to you that there are legitimate threats that people face, that the police cannot adequately protect you in every case, and that there is a legitimate need for guns to defend yourselves because criminals have them, then there is a right to a gun and a right to the Second Amendment that we believe is incredibly important. Lastly, I want to talk about why the Second Amendment is particularly important to protecting this right. We believe the idea behind constitutionally protected rights is to create a backstop against legislative or majoritarian tyranny. That public opinion surrounding gun rights, or even a public opinion within the government, can change in a heartbeat. That the Second Amendment does not prohibit safe and productive policies like background checks to prevent criminals from getting guns, or even bans on assault weapons like we had in the 1990s. Instead, we believe the Second Amendment draws a line in the sand and says, here but no further. The government cannot go any further than this. They say the Second Amendment prevents us from passing things like background checks. That is manifestly untrue. D.C. v. Heller, the very Supreme Court case that they discuss, actually affirmed the fact that the Second Amendment does not give us an unlimited right to guns, and the Supreme Court has said specifically that we do have a right to limit it in cases where it is productive to do so. What they have pointed out is a problem with our political system, that groups like the NRA or other lobbying groups are able to cloud the process. Their solution, then, to a political problem is to repeal the Second Amendment entirely. We believe that this is a solution that is to swat a fly with a sledgehammer, that they don't need to take away the entire Second Amendment because there are problems with our political system. They need to tell you why we need to get rid of the Second Amendment, not why we need to change our political system. They say they don't want to take guns away from you, and that is their big point. Our response to this is that without the Second Amendment, they can't guarantee that they won't. The Second Amendment prevents the government from taking away our rights when the majority wishes to do so. Without the Second Amendment, their guarantee and their words that they won't take them away mean nothing. So, what are the arguments that we heard out of Amy? The first thing she talked about was the purpose of the Second Amendment. She told us that the Second Amendment was passed during a war and that we don't need it anymore. That is untrue. The Second Amendment was passed because we have a right to self-defense. What we are defending ourselves from may have changed, but that right to self-defense has not. It is just as real as it was in the 1700s. They need to prove to you that we don't need it anymore. I don't think they've done that. The second argument that they made was they talked about the threat to federalism. Essentially, they said that the Second Amendment is designed to protect us from tyrannical government, but that what we really want is for state and local governments to be able to make their own decisions. So the problem with this argument is that if you repeal the Second Amendment, this doesn't let state and local governments make their own decisions. It allows the federal government to make decisions about the gun rights of North Carolinians and Alaskans and every other state in our nation. The Supreme Court in the McDonald case told us that state and local governments were also bound by the Second Amendment. Perhaps they were wrong, and we're not going to say that this doesn't go beyond the original intent of the amendment. But its original intent, and the reason it's on the books, is to prevent the federal government from making decisions about the gun rights of everyone in our country, from preventing state and local governments from making decisions about their citizens' needs. That is what happens when you repeal the Second Amendment. It is why the guarantee of self-defense and the guarantee of a right to bear arms goes away, that this right goes away when you do not have an amendment to guarantee it. They talk about room for discourse and say that the Second Amendment makes this untouchable. If that were true, we wouldn't have had assault weapons bans. If that were true, we wouldn't have had handgun bans. If that were true, none of these policies would have ever happened. This is a political problem, not a gun problem. Don't swat a fly with a sledgehammer. We're very proud to oppose this motion.
Thank you. I want to start off today with an area of agreement rather than disagreement, and that is a heartfelt thank you to the audience here. It's overwhelming and it's completely humbling to have an audience not only of this size but of this caliber, and so thank you very much for coming out. We're very grateful. But let's move on to the disagreement because there's a lot more of that. The problem that Amy and I have with the Second Amendment is it privileges a tool that we have for which we have a utilitarian justification on the level of a fundamental inherent right, where it is in fact something that we have a utilitarian interest in maintaining, but the elevation of that right has restricted our ability and continues to restrict our ability to regulate that tool effectively, as all tools must be regulated. So in my speech, I'm going to talk about why you have where there's a fundamental difference between the legitimate claim to gun ownership and the fundamental right of self-defense. And I'm going to talk about why it is that the Second Amendment privileges unfairly one side of our debate over gun regulation over the other, and the very negative impact that that has on our discourse and dialogue, and why it has truly prevented us from doing even the most common sense things, like passing universal background checks so that people with multiple felony convictions or a history of mental illness can't go out and buy a gun with absolutely no check on them whatsoever. First, I want to engage in a little bit of deconstruction, though, from what we've heard from our previous speaker. He hinted in his speech that, you know, when people come to take away our rights, and there are still those people out there, we need guns to defend ourselves. But the time has passed when arming ourselves and acting violently within our own nation is the best way that we can recognize rights. That time has long since passed. And if you look at any of the truly historic and truly monumental quests for realized rights that we have, whether it's the civil rights movement or the right for women to vote, none of these rights movements would have been better served by arming ourselves. So maybe it had a place when we were rebelling against the government in England, but it certainly doesn't have a place in our quest for other rights today, especially within our own nation. No, thank you. And so the second idea is that somehow, without the Second Amendment, we have no means of stopping oppressive laws from being passed. And that's really not true, because we don't live in, you know, communist Russia or communist China. We live in America. We live in the United States, where we have a democracy, we have elected representatives, and we have the ability to unelect those representatives and change those laws as we see fit. And we also have many other legitimate claims, many other tools. Like Amy mentioned, we have cars, we have business licenses, we have the ability to travel to other nations and internationally. All of these are very important things that we recognize are existing and worthy of protection within our lives, but they're not protected within the Bill of Rights, because just as these things have benefits and value to us, they also have a need for regulation, because they can potentially pose harm to us. And like any other tool, the right and the claim to own guns and the Second Amendment is something that needs to be regulated, and it doesn't need to be elevated to the level of fundamental individual rights. No, thank you. Now, I want to talk in my first constructive point here about why the right to self-defense is fundamentally distinct from your legitimate claim to gun ownership. But they're not one and the same. And this doesn't mean, as I said, that your claim to gun ownership is illegitimate, but whereas self-defense is an inherent good, by itself a terminal goal, gun ownership is a tool valuable only in its utility to help you recognize that goal. So it is an instrumental goal. Now, we have conflicting rights as interests and interests that we have to balance. And like community security and safety, we have to elevate these things to the same level of self-defense. And we recognize that the tool of gun ownership and the tool that we have with gun ownership is something that both can help one right, like self-defense, as well as harm another right, like community security. And so if you look at some more radical examples of your right to keep arms, to bear arms, you might be better served in terms of your right to self-defense by surrounding your house with landmines in your yard. These are arms that you might bear against somebody who comes uninvited to your house, where only you and your family have the code and the pattern to those landmines. But this does outrageous harm to our community security, and this does outrageous harm to our community safety. And so even though that tool might help you better realize your right to self-defense, it does unacceptable harm to community safety and security, and so we recognize that it's not something worthy of inherent protection. And when it comes to things like guns, large magazines, fully automatic rifles, concealed carry of handguns, these are things that, while maybe helping you to protect your right to self-defense, also pose threats to community safety and security. And it should be up to us, and it should be up to our regulatory bodies and our elected officials to decide what is the best balance there. And that's not a debate that needs to be artificially stymied by the presence of the Second Amendment, but that's exactly what we have in the status quo. Go ahead.
So people certainly don't need landmines to defend themselves, but let's suppose an armed invader enters someone's home and the police are not there to defend them. How would you have them defend themselves?
Well, Amy said many times, and I'll repeat it, we're not trying to take away all of our guns. But what we're saying is that there is reasonable limitations that we have not been able to pass, like universal background checks for the purchase of guns, because we've elevated gun ownership to the level of an inherent right fundamental to every individual, and that's not where it should be. You have a legitimate claim to gun ownership, but it is not an inherent fundamental right on par with your claim to life or on par with your community's claim to security. And as it serves as a tool, we should regulate it. Now, the second point here is this. Well, and first, I want to make this point that although these are competing interests we have, community security and self-defense, these are not competing groups of people. Although the same parent who has an interest in having a gun in the home to protect their children or their family has an equal interest in making sure that public schools are safe places to be, and public locations are safe places to be, and theaters are safe places to be. And so although these are competing interests, these are really one and the same group of people, and we have to be able to balance these interests as we see fit. Now, the second point is that the Second Amendment disproportionately privileges one side of this debate over the other, because they make the claim in their speech that we have absolutely no problem regulating guns to whatever degree we want. To. And in that regard, I find it somewhat a timid defense of the Second Amendment. But the simple fact is that we have found ourselves completely incapable of doing even the most fundamental or basic things, like passing universal background checks, which just recently failed. And so by elevating that tool, which for we have a utilitarian justification, we stymie the debate and we close the debate down prematurely. And Amy talks about, and I talked about, how we have many other things for which we have a utilitarian claim and a utilitarian justification, like driving cars, like traveling to other countries, or like owning a business, that we don't protect and we don't enshrine within the Bill of Rights because these are valuable only insofar as they promote the other truly inherent rights that we have, like safety, like self-defense, and like community security. Now, what does the Second Amendment and what does the repeal of the Second Amendment do for our discourse? Because it frees us up and allows us to engage in this debate more meaningfully and more effectively. Now, he's right that the gun lobby is still going to exist. And tomorrow, when we repeal the Second Amendment, the NRA is still going to exist in much the same form that it does today. But our laws, and our Constitution especially, shape our public discourse and the grounds on which we have that discourse and debate. And so we can see that while America's very distinct view of guns and gun ownership, as Amy and I see it, unjustifiably a fundamental and inherent right, is shaped by the Second Amendment, the repeal of the Second Amendment also serves to meaningfully shape that discourse and have a very real impact on that debate that we have. It also will allow greater regulation and control that we don't have within the status quo. And he mentions that we've had previously different types of gun regulations and restrictions on gun ownership. There's a great example in 1968 where we had extremely restrictive gun ownership. But the Second Amendment, as Amy said, doesn't exist as a static monolith. And it changes and it evolves over time. So we recognize that whereas the Second Amendment was created to protect individual states from an oppressive federal government, we understand that that's fundamentally not the purpose of the Second Amendment today. And just like it has changed since then, it has changed since 1968. And so when we've seen the landmark Supreme Court rulings like 2007 in the Heller decision in 2010 against Chicago, we've seen that the Second Amendment has been fundamentally altered to be much more restrictive to the goal of sensible regulation, and we've seen that come to a climax here with our vote down of universal background checks on the basis that the congressional officials believed it violated the Second Amendment. So we've been unable to have that effective discourse, and we're unable to have it now, and we need to. Thank you.
Neither Josh, nor I, nor the conservative wing of the Supreme Court, nor presumably most individuals in this room argue for an unqualified right to bear arms. There is no right to own a tank. There is no right to plant mines in your backyard. There is no right to own automatic military assault rifles. And as we've seen in Heller, there also isn't even a right to be able to carry your gun in a concealed manner or to not have a background check before you actually obtain a weapon. But what we argue in this debate is that when government argues that they want common sense regulations, we don't disagree with that aim. What we do think happens, though, is that when they repeal the Second Amendment, they make it far less likely that you'll actually get the common sense regulations that they advocate for. And even if they are capable of achieving these things, they do so at far too high a cost of liberty, which is the threat of eradicating guns from society altogether, something that we think contravenes basic rights to self-defense and to participate in activities that are culturally important to Americans and have been so for hundreds of years. So in this speech, I'm going to do two things. First, I'm going to delve more deeply into the arguments that we received from the opposition or from the government team in the past two speeches. And then I'm going to re-explain what some of our justifications were for why this right is so important and why those trump the utilitarian concerns that they bring up in this debate repeatedly. So one argument that we hear consistently is that federalism is critically important and we need to allow the states to make these individual assessments. The problem, as Josh told you though, or as I told you rather, is that if you repeal the Second Amendment, you're not actually going to be able to have meaningful regulation on the state level. Rather, on the federal level, you'll have people imposing their own values on the individual states. We don't think that this should be the case, and we think that the Second Amendment prevents this from happening by ensuring that states can make their own decisions about gun rights instead of having the federal government impose limitations upon them. But even within states and even within cities, there are sometimes certain groups of individuals, vocal minorities, who care about protecting their gun rights even against a majority that wants to take them away. And so we think that because this is such a critical right, because it allows you to engage in self-defense, these can't be rights that can be taken away by the majority even within a state and even within a city. But the next thing that they talk about, and sort of the argument that they hinge most of their case on, is this idea about discourse and about how when you have a Second Amendment, it makes it that much more difficult to actually pass legislation regulating the Second Amendment. We don't think this is actually the case. We told you that DC v. Heller did not prevent background checks from being passed. Rather, it was the special interest groups that they themselves speak about that prevented these background checks from being passed. Now, the question, of course, is why these special interest groups, which in some cases previously supported things like universal background checks, decided to back away from them. And I think there's a pretty obvious and common sense explanation that many individuals have given, which is that the fear is that once you allow for some impositions on this right, it becomes the case that society can regulate it even more to the point where it becomes impossible for you to exercise that right in the first place. So the question I pose to you is this: Are people more likely to give on the common sense regulations if there's a possibility that their right can be regulated away altogether because there is no backstop? Or are they more willing to concede in the future when there is some recognition that even if people can make it more difficult for you to own arms or limit the types of arms you can own, there's no way for them to ultimately take away your right to bear arms at all? That's the assurance we get on our side, and it's something that I think is going to make reform and compromise much more likely to happen in the long term.
Sure. Constitutional interpretation is not only relevant as it happens within the judiciary, but as it happens within Congress and within the public too. And you can't say that our view of the Second Amendment is distinct from our refusal to pass basic things like universal background checks.
So my argument is this: there's nothing in the Second Amendment preventing this from being passed. So the question is how this influences the discourse and how this influences people's incentives. If people fear that this right can be taken away altogether, they're that much more likely to be afraid of passing any sort of reform. But if there is some guarantee that they're still going to have some basic right, that reform is that much more likely to happen. But I also think there's another change to the discourse that takes place when you get rid of the Second Amendment. So we've already explained that people fear criminals, obviously. They don't want to be the victims of crime. And so they're willing to go to whatever measures are necessary to ensure that they're not going to be the victims of crime. So when you're in a situation where you're no longer capable of protecting yourself from criminals, what are you going to do? You're going to turn even more heavily to the police, and you're going to allow for public policy that ultimately can be oppressive and ultimately can violate other liberties. So what we think will happen is if people are actually capable of taking away the Second Amendment right to bear arms, or if people fear that their Second Amendment rights are going to be taken away in the future by the popular will, they're more willing to give the police all sorts of powers they shouldn't have, and that's what allows for tyranny of the majority. Maybe it's a different sort of governmental tyranny than we feared about hundreds of years ago, but it's still a tyranny we should be afraid of, which is allowing the police, for example, to conduct more searches unregulated or to surveil more people. We think this is just as bad, and it's something that we can prevent when individuals know that they have some guarantee and that they don't need to rely so heavily on the government, even to the extent that it impinges on their basic liberties. But the final argument that we heard from the government team deals with this idea that we should view the Second Amendment in a utilitarian manner, and we shouldn't look to it as a right. I think there are a few reasons why this isn't the case, and they're probably best realized by looking at an analogy. So we generally don't blindly defer to collective security over individual rights in all sorts of situations. In fact, we commonly prioritize individual rights over group claims all the time. Unpopular speech can cause violence in society, and it may make many people happy if we banned speech that was unpopular, but we still don't do it because we protect an individual right to expression. Similarly, we grant all sorts of rights to criminals, even though those procedural rights have real trade-offs with the safety of society. So I would tell you that if we're willing to grant suspected criminals individual rights that trump the collective right to safety, surely law-abiding citizens should be due a meaningful right to defend their very lives. And that's the thing that they potentially infringe upon on their side when they make it possible for the government to regulate away the right to bear arms altogether.
But I want to also deal with the justifications that we gave you for why this right is so important, because I don't think that they were adequately dealt with in the last speech. So we told you first that there's this basic right to self-defense that has to trump these other considerations out there. And the response we get is that we need more regulation. As Josh and I told you, we agree with reasonable regulation, but when you actually create a climate in which people fear that their gun rights might be taken away altogether, that regulation is less likely to happen. And the fact that we need regulation doesn't mean that we can suddenly trample upon the rights of individual people and take away a right that is necessary. When Josh asks the POI of what happens when a criminal invades your house and the police can't get there, how are you supposed to defend yourself, and we don't get an adequate response to this, I think it's particularly damning. What are individuals supposed to do if the police can't help them? And I think that individuals only give up their right to use force to the state because the state agrees to protect them. So when the state no longer engages in this protection and leaves them to defend for themselves and then prevents them from having adequate tools to defend themselves, there's a severe impingement on rights that's taking place, and it's something that's unconscionable. But the other argument we gave you deals with the cultural and historical value of the Second Amendment. Granted, there are lots of things about our culture that have changed over the years, but I would argue that the right to bear arms and sort of the historical importance of this is something that hasn't changed over the years, and that's why we still see, for example, this reluctance to regulate guns away in many parts of the country. In addition, though, I think there's more than a cultural claim and sort of a claim to livelihood that derives from this right to bear arms. If I live in an area that's remote and there are animals that could be attacking my house or attacking my children, it's probably pretty important that I have a firearm rather than just knives in my bare hands to deal with a bear that's attacking my family. If I, for example, have livestock and I need to protect them from wild animals or else I'm not going to be able to make a living, it's probably important that I have a right to bear arms that can't be infringed upon by the government just because the majority in a state might live in cities where this isn't actually a concern. And if I live in a part of the country where I actually provide for myself primarily through hunting, and the government takes that right away from me because other individuals in the state don't share that concern, that's another right that is being impinged upon. We think there are all sorts of things that are important for people to live their lives in a meaningful way, to feel culturally connected to their country, and to defend themselves when the police don't adequately do so, and these are potentially impinged on by the Second Amendment. At the very least, we think we don't make the discourse any worse. We make people more willing to actually make these concessions because there's some guarantee in place. But at the end of the day, we think even if that isn't true, these rights are so fundamental that they need to be respected, even if that comes at high costs. We're very proud to oppose.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Harvard University Debate Team argue against the UAA Seawolf Debate Team on repealing the Second Amendment. This debate was recorded at the Beartooth Theater Pub on April 25th. We're going to skip ahead to the closing arguments, but if you would like to hear the comments from the audience, we've posted full video and a podcast of the debate at alaskapublic.org.
My thanks to all of you for being considerate listeners and convicted speakers and for your attention and civility in considering these exchanges. We're now going to turn to the closing speeches from each side. Each side will have 1 5-minute opportunity to present the summary of their side and their last closing argument. As is tradition, we'll begin with the proposition and close with those who would propose a change from the status quo. So I'd like to welcome Harvard back to the podium to make their closing case.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to close this debate by asking 2 questions. First, what does the Second Amendment do? We heard from side proposition that it does 2 things. First, they tell us that it privileges one side of the debate. And this argument, by the way, hinges on 1 example, just 1. They say that this is why universal background checks failed. But they failed to engage with all the other examples we've shown you about cases where it didn't fail, where we were able to pass meaningful regulation, like the assault weapons ban of the 1990s. And we're probably going to have another assault weapons ban if Congress does its job with the bill that's on the floor right now. We've had handgun bans. We have background checks for many places that sell guns right now. They point you to 1 example, but don't engage with the broader cases where we show you that we have been able to regulate, and we tell you that this type of regulation will continue to do its job. They propose a constitutional solution for a political problem. In fact, the solution that they propose is akin to saying that if we couldn't pass a law banning us from yelling fire in a crowded theater, that we should repeal the First Amendment. This makes no sense. We don't need to go this far. We believe our rights are meaningful. We say we should protect them. But the second thing they tell us about the Second Amendment is they tell us what it doesn't do. They don't seem to believe that it has any protective effect on our rights whatsoever. This is where they try to have their cake in typical debater fashion and eat it too. They tell us that, trust us, if we repeal the Second Amendment, we'll never take away your rights, believe us. This is nonsensical. In two cities already, we have tried to pass universal handgun bans. This is not some far-off prospect. There are governments that have tried to take away people's gun rights. It is not hypothetical. If they're willing to do it now with the Second Amendment on the books, imagine what they'll be willing to do when it isn't. Without the Second Amendment, every accident or tragedy will become a cause to ban all guns, to ban this right for everyone. The ultimate question that we need to answer is, do all of you trust the federal government to never take away the right to guns at any point in the future? Because without the Second Amendment, provide a backstop to prevent this sort of tyranny and to protect this right in its most basic form, that is not a guarantee that they can make on their side of the house. But on our side, we tell you that the Second Amendment does do a couple of very useful things. That it prevents us from needing a tyranny of the police. That if people can defend themselves, the police don't need to be in everyone's homes. They don't need to conduct more invasive searches, because they don't need to be there to protect our rights all the time, because we can do it ourselves. We also told you, though, that with the Second Amendment on the books, it makes people more willing to accept the sorts of intermediate regulations that we already have. That if there is no constitutional backstop, every law suddenly becomes an affront to our most basic rights, because there is no more protection. That's the situation on their side of the house. Without the Second Amendment, there is no guarantee, so regulation becomes far harder to pass. The second question I want to ask, and the final question, is, does this right matter, or is it just about utility? First, we've told you that the right to a gun and the Second Amendment are essential to our right to self-defense. We've told you that in cases where the police cannot protect us, people need guns to protect themselves from home invaders, from gangs, and other violent criminals. These threats are real. Again, they are not just hypotheticals, and proposition can't just wish them away. They tell us, well, yes, but we're not going to take away your gun, so if someone invades your home, trust us, you'll still have a gun. Again, these are just empty words without a Second Amendment to back them up and make them real. The police may not be there, and when they are not, we say people should have a gun to defend themselves. That, sure, Wiley's brother may not believe people can tell a home invader from someone who's going to steal your TV, but we believe with adequate training programs, people can. That this is a right people should be able to actualize on, and that in the past they have. Second of all, we tell you, it is important to our cultural heritage that our founding emphasized individualism, and that without the right to bear arms, this country would not exist, and that it is an affront to our heritage to remove this protection. Finally, as Coulter explained, this right is essential to the livelihood of Americans all across this country who need to protect their family or their livestock, who need to hunt for food for their livelihood. We tell you that the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms have kept our country safe for generations. They point to events in the past few weeks that have made the Second Amendment politically inconvenient. But again, the ultimate question is, does political inconvenience justify throwing away this right entirely? Our rights, we believe, are important. We believe on our side of the house that we have an obligation to protect them, that once you remove this law from the books, we cannot go back. If you believe the Second Amendment is useful, if you believe that it has protected our rights in the past, then you ought to believe that it will continue to do so, that without it, this right will be imperiled, our right to self-defense will become far less strong, and Americans will be far less safe. For all of these reasons, we are incredibly proud to oppose the motion.
The last speech and all of opposition bench is fraught with the very same scare tactics that pro-Second Amendment people use to frighten the good people like us. It is full of these slippery slope arguments that if we allow regulations in one way, that it is going to completely dismantle society or your ability to protect yourself. We say no. I'm going to grant you two questions in today's debate to summarize what has happened so far. First, how will people defend themselves without the Second Amendment? And second, is this a political or a legal problem? So first, how will people defend themselves without the Second Amendment? We were told, look, if the police can't get to your house, what's gonna happen? What we would say is three responses. First, people are probably still gonna have guns. I will explain more later. Second, even if you don't have a gun, there are far more effective tools that you can use to defend yourself. Tasers,
pepper spray, security systems actually are more efficient and more accurate in close range combat than guns actually are. And what we would say is that you are far less likely to have to defend yourself in your home with a gun when you live in a safer community. And if you agree that on our side of the house, we give you a safer community, you lessen the need for people to even have guns in their homes to protect themselves in the first place. And then we were told, look, this is going to lead to a tyranny of the police or a tyranny of the government. What we would say is that's a slippery slope argument. I'll explain a little bit more in my second point. But more importantly, Wiley told you that we have other ways and other mechanisms of people to be able to address their grievances with the government. And what we've told you are historical context for when people were being oppressed, like the civil rights movement, like the women's rights movements, that nonviolent means have actually been far more effective in overcoming tyranny and overcoming these sorts of problems. So when they tell you that we have to have guns and we need to act violently to overcome tyranny, we say that that is old, it is archaic, and it is simply ineffective. So let's talk about this second question. Is this a political or a legal problem? Because we were told, look, this is a political problem. We have problems with lobbyists. We have problems with regulation. If you have problems with those things, just fix the regulation. We would say is that the legal existence of the Second Amendment is inexplicably linked with our political action on gun issues in two particular ways. First and foremost, laws shape our perception. Just as like we have taboos on things like alcohol and drugs, those stem from our laws, and public perception comes from our laws and how we interpret them and how we see that they have relevance in our modern day lives. So long as the Second Amendment exists, it will always influence public perception against reasonable restrictions on guns. It's been proven, it's been shown, Wiley and I have given you those examples. The second reason that the legal existence is inexplicably linked with legal action is that no one in Congress wants to touch gun control issues. Just like the threat of a veto or a filibuster makes people shy away from what would otherwise be controversial decisions, action from the Supreme Court that would overturn a law is an equal deterrent for Congress. Congress does not want to act out against the Second Amendment because they know those decisions that they make will be overturned. So for them to say this is a political problem, not a legal problem, fails to recognize the inexplicable link that exists between the two things. So long as those two things are linked, and they always will be, what we have shown you is that political action can only happen if the legal existence of the Second Amendment no longer is there. What they would tell you is that, look, we can regulate these things. We've done it in the past, but we have, because of the Second Amendment, we have a shifting presumption away from regulation and towards unregulated gun use in America. They say, look, we used to have an assault ban. Yeah, what happened to that assault ban? It sunset and no one repassed it. No one wanted to reinstate it. And we're having the same argument that we had in the 1990s about the gun assault ban, and we've made no progress. So don't tell me that we can regulate it, because we can't. It has been shown that we can't, and we have been shown that politicians are unwilling to do so. And then we were told, look, the political ramifications are terrible in this case, because if the Second Amendment is repealed, the government would become oppressive. What we would say is that you don't have to have a constitutional right to have a utilitarian claim. Just because cars are popular, and cars actually kill more people than guns do, we don't see people flocking to ban cars or to ban driving. No one wants to do those things. And opposition is using the same scare tactics, the same slippery slope fallacy, that if we don't have the Second Amendment, that guns will completely go away. I would say that the proud people of Alaska would never let that happen. They would still have guns, you know, for available for use, for in their home, or for hunting, or for hiking, and we'd still be able to have reasonable restrictions. But what we tell you is that discourse cannot happen because the Second Amendment's legal existence is linked with our political action and our lack of common sense political action. What we tell you is that self-defense still happens on our side of the house. We still respect people's utilitarian claim to using a gun. But when you don't have a right and the Second Amendment does not exist as a legal document, it gives us the ability to become a safer community and to make common sense laws. We're proud to propose.
At the end of debates in the British House of Commons, the discourse is punctuated by something called a division of the House. Now, in the House of Commons, the division of the House occurs when the members file out a door marked aye or nay to indicate either their support for or their rejection of the motion that's being debated. I'm not going to make you walk out a door and count you as you do, but I think it's good for us to have a division of the House by voice vote. So in a second, I'm going to ask those who are in favor of the motion, those who would support the repeal of the Second Amendment, to say aye, and those who are opposed to the motion that would oppose the notion of repealing the Second Amendment to say nay. Let's do that now. All those in favor of the motion that would support the repeal of the Second Amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And all those opposed, please say nay.
Nay.
I'm going to call this one for Harvard. Congratulations, gentlemen. Thank you again to the debaters, and thank you to all of you for coming out. Remember that at the end of the day, a debate is not an end of the discussion, but a beginning. Continue the dialogue, and make sure you engage one another on these important questions. Thank you all very much.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to a Second Amendment debate on Addressing Alaskans. Arguing to repeal the Second Amendment, the UAA Sea Wolves went up against Harvard University debate team at the Beartooth Theater Pub on April 25th, 2013. There is video and an audio podcast of the entire debate, including audience responses, at alaskapublic.org. Special thanks to Kathleen McCoy, who takes care of the UAA podcast and recorded this week's show. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.